From Michigan Radio, this is The Living Room. I'm Allison Downey. On today's show, migration stories. I know, we all hear about people leaving Michigan, but they also come here for all sorts of reasons. Coming up, after a string of ridiculous and sometimes painful day jobs in Texas, I somehow end up in Michigan. And then, one family's journey from North Carolina all the way to Covert, Michigan.
They wanted to cross the Ohio River where there was no slavery and pursue freedom and happiness.
Later, Lansing-based songwriter Joshua Davis stops by Studio East with his band. He'll play some tunes for us and share his parents' migration story.
I got a tale to tell you, Lord, you know it won't take long.
It's all coming up in The Living Room. You're listening to The Living Room. I'm Allison Downey on Michigan Radio. I think stories are central to who we are as people, and they shape our identity. So for our show, whether it's through stories or songs or poetry, our hope is that we can uncover parts of Michigan that people wouldn't normally know about. There's been a lot of press recently about people leaving Michigan. So we wanted to look at what brings people to Michigan.
I moved to Michigan for a job.
To be honest with you, I did not want to come to Michigan.
I wanted to be closer to my grandson, so I left 92-degree weather to come to 13-degree weather.
I'm from Washington, D.C. originally, but I moved to Michigan because, well, Michigan called. No, really? So here's the story. I was living in Texas, running a theater company that did social justice work. And I just finished graduate school in theater and education and co-founded this company with my best friend. This was like a dream job. It was all-consuming. It paid next to nothing. I loved it. But I was also a singer-songwriter and dreamed of pursuing music. I just didn't have enough time for it because I overinvested in my other career. But then I get this opportunity to cut my first album with these amazing producers. This was the place, and with these producers, this was the time. And the only way to make that dream happen was to get a day job where I could just phone it in. So I became a temp. I started phoning it in at a major cell phone company in the collections department. It was mindless work. I was really bored, so I put my theater training to work and made up characters.
Hey there, sweet pea. This here's Melba, and I'm just calling to gab about that nasty little bill you ain't had a chance to pay yet.
Most of the people don't pay their bills because they're in trouble. So it's a terrible thing to have to call people and badger them about it.
Now you just tell me what's going on. Now, are you doing all right?
And the customers got along great with Melba. And I was having so much fun that I decided to invite Carmen.
Hello, this is Carmen. And I have not yet received your check. And I wonder if there is a problem.
Customers loved Carmen. And then I started caring about my customers.
Are you okay?
And I couldn't help myself. I got invested. And I pitched to the boss man a restructuring of the system. And he says,
go for it. I love initiative.
So I start working late. It's cutting into my rehearsal time. At night, I'm thinking about customers instead of songs. I'm a total failure at phoning it in at my phone job.
Well, sometimes it helps to talk about it.
3 weeks later, everything's working so well. And the boss comes up to me and he says,
I love your new system. Really efficient.
So efficient, they didn't need me anymore. So I was essentially fired for improving customer service.
Well, I think that's it.
I had a come to Jesus talk with myself because I had just overinvested in a temp position. They are asking you not to commit to it. The only way to do it is if it's me and a machine, because clearly anything that involves people, I overinvest in. So my next job is for a scanning company. So it's just me and like one other guy who's 45 years old. He's kind of rumpled. He's kind of big. And we are sitting at our machines in silence for 9 hours a day, just scanning, scanning, scanning. And we're in a trailer. There's no drinking water. There is no toilet paper. Right? It's a really nice environment. I notice after a while that he is scratching his ankles, and continually. And by the end of the day, my ankles start itching too. And I ask him about it, and he says,
I don't know nothing.
which kind of ends the conversation. So the next day I come back, and he's like scratching all over, and so am I. I'm scratching everywhere. And so I go on my lunch break, and I go to public health because I have no insurance because I'm a temp. And I learned from a very nice doctor there named Dr. Payne, no joke, that I have contracted scabies from the nasty chairs in the trailer. Scabies is a highly contagious skin disease caused by mites burrowing under your skin. Nice. So I return to work and I tell my coworker, you know, you must have scabies too. And he says, I don't know nothing. And so I go tell my boss, who says, you have scabies? Gross. You are totally fired. Really? So I am covered in insecticide that I have to keep on for 24 hours. And I'm hanging out with my friend who says, listen, you have got to get a real job, like a normal job that won't give you scabies. And I tell her, you know, I can't. I can't be trusted to set boundaries with my work. We're just about to start recording. I can't get myself distracted. It's not worth it. And she says, it doesn't have to be 24/7. There's got to be a middle ground between working nonstop, saving the world, and jobs that give you contagious diseases. It's like a newsflash, right? She finds the perfect one. So for my third job, I'm an administrative assistant at a record label. Lots of learning potential, not too much responsibility. It's a 9-to-5, so even if I overinvest, it's for music. I dive in. I love working with the artist, and I'm making all these connections for my CD, musicians, designers, and my boss, Mark. He's a former banker. He's twice my age and half my height. And he kind of takes me under his wing, and he encourages me every step of the way. So it's the perfect solution. But I mean, I knew that there were some weird things too. My first day when I started working, the place was filthy. It was disgusting. I'm the only woman in the office. There are Playboy magazines everywhere. After a little bit of time, I learned that the meetings at the North office actually meant the Yellow Rose of Texas strip club. Luckily, I wasn't invited. And the owner, Billy, is a multimillionaire philanthropist, but he was also a little bit of a drunk. And he would stumble through the door like one of the Beverly Hillbillies and say things like, Allison, I just bought me another oil tanker and I'm fixing it up to be my own cruise ship. And then he'd instruct me to spend the next 3 days coming up with names for the boat. And sometimes I get a call that Billy had passed out on a lawn somewhere and Mark would send me to pick him up. So this was my job. There were compromises, but they were ones I was willing to make. Until one day, Mark asks if I want to go to a formal benefit with everyone from the office. So I arrive all dressed up in my $16 sequin dress, and there's Mark in his tux. And no one else is there. Creepy. A white stretch limo pulls up, and I'm hoping maybe everybody else is inside. Mark opens the door. We climb in. I can smell Billy, who's completely plastered, with an equally drunk former employee in a backless dress who is not his wife. It becomes very clear that Mark, my boss, is my date. And I do have boundaries when it comes to my work. This was not the kind of investment I was willing to make. The CD was almost done. I was so happy with it. I wanted to continue in music, but not only music. And at that moment in the limo, I really missed my other career that seemed to have a little more integrity. I didn't know what to do. I was just about to return to my life as a scabies temp when Michigan called. Well, actually, Western Michigan. It's the head of the theater department from a university in a town I didn't know existed, calling to tell me that I had been recommended for a faculty position in educational theater, and would I come interview? After an all-nighter in the studio, finishing the CD, I board a plane to Kalamazoo. During my 3-day interview, I taught a few classes. I loved the students. The faculty was amazing. My boss was a stand-up guy, which I really appreciated. My creative work, including music, was considered part of the job. And a cinch the deal, Michigan was beautiful. Flowers, green grass everywhere. And from South Haven's Lighthouse Pier, the waves of Lake Michigan reminded me of the ocean from my childhood. It felt like home. But I had never seen water so crystal blue before. So 3 weeks later, I drive north, away from the Texas heat, with my white Persian cat in the front seat and a U-Haul trailing behind. It was here in Michigan that I released the CD. I found the place where I could overinvest in all my dreams in the same job. In Michigan, I could have it all.
Michigan, my steam for dunes where sleeping bears dream of white-tailed deer, tall white pine, sulfur fields or copper mines in Michigan. Begin again. Land of hope and broken dreams, you see.
I'm Allison Downey. That was my new song, Begin Again. Singer-songwriter Joshua Davis is coming up, and he's going to share with us his parents' migration story. That's in 15 minutes in the living room from Michigan Radio. I'm Allison Downey. You're listening to The Living Room on Michigan Radio. Do you have a bird that has a favorite call?
That is probably the mourning dove because I can make the call. My name is Arden. I'm 7 years old and I live in Kalamazoo, Michigan.
What is migration?
Migration is when something moves from one place to another. Usually for winter so they can get to a warmer place.
Today we're talking about migration, not just of birds, but of people. Why would somebody uproot themselves from their home to move someplace new? I used to be a history teacher, so when I think of migration, I immediately think of the Great Migration, when African Americans moved from the South to the North during the first half of the 20th century. So I asked my friend, Annalisa Cox, a historian, if she knew of any compelling stories from that time. Of course she did, but she said that there was another movement of free African Americans to Michigan that most people don't know about, that started before the Civil War. And while the Great Migration was rural to urban, the earlier one wasn't.
They were not going to the cities. They were going to the frontier. They were staking their claim to what was then called the West. And what they mean is Ohio, Indiana, Illinois, Michigan.
So Annalisa points out that the way to get ahead back then, whether you were white or black, was to own land and to run a successful farm.
That was the American dream of the first half of the 19th century.
In her research, Annalisa discovered the Connor family. They were free African Americans living in Snow Hill, North Carolina, but they ended up in Michigan.
The Connors had been free since the 17th century, so well before our nation became a nation. The family lore has it that they owned a large turpentine plantation, and that was the name given to a farm at the time. And they were quite wealthy off of this.
But even though the Connors were technically free and would otherwise be living the American dream,
there were more and more laws put into place that made being free in these states much, much more difficult. Everything from the loss of the right to vote in North Carolina, the loss of the right to gather together and worship with an African-American pastor, the right to teach your children to read and write.
So the Connors decided to leave North Carolina. They were going to walk to Michigan. There, they'd become leaders building a racially harmonious settlement unlike any place in the country at that time. What follows is a story of their journey that's been passed down orally from generation to generation in this one West Michigan family.
My name is Ted Anderson. I live in Kalamazoo, Michigan. I am the great-great-grandson of William Bright Connor, who traveled from North Carolina in 1849, I believe, with his children and family. And he took along with him his sister Rose and three young men, the Tyler boys, he referred to them as. They wanted to cross the Ohio River where it was no slavery and pursue freedom and happiness.
Leaving North Carolina meant they would almost certainly never be able to return, because at that point there were laws in place that said if you were free African American and you left the state boundaries, that if you ever returned, you could be legally sold into slavery.
You lose your wagon, your horse, everything that you have, all that's gone.
They might as well have been escaping bondage.
William Bright decided to leave, so he sold his turpentine plantation, and then they quietly left from that area and started their trip north. The wagon was only big enough to carry of William Bright Connor's wife and his sister. The kids pretty much had to walk. You're talking about North Carolina to the Ohio River there in Indiana. That's a long walk.
They would have just been going through heavily wooded or farmland areas. Because they had that wagon, they didn't have the option for cutting across land. They had to stay on trails and roads. The added burden of being a black pioneer is that you couldn't even get the shelter that you needed. The vast majority of cabins had to be avoided because you didn't know who was living in them, whether they were trustworthy, whether this was somebody who would try to molest or kidnap your family.
They traveled further, and then they crossed the Blue Ridge Mountains, and they could look down, they could see the clouds, and they could even see it raining, not on them, but down below. This is how high they had to travel to cross over. And as would happen along the way, the slave patrollers would come and question them and demand to see their free papers. When you're born black in this country, if you were free, then there was documentations that showed that you were not a slave and that you were a free individual.
And in fact, they did end up losing a member of their family on that journey before they were out of the slave states.
William Bright Connor's sister Rose couldn't produce her free papers, so the slavers took her. And there was nothing they could do about that.
And they never saw her again?
It's assumed she was sold back into slavery.
And after that point, they traveled only at night.
And they got to the Ohio River.
This is like the Red Sea. This is the river that is separating them from the slave lands to the free lands. It's very, very beautiful. It's winding very, very wide. By the time that they came to that river in the 1840s, there would have been thousands of these steamships that were going up and down the river. These ships would have had slaves in chains on them. I got to cross. there were obviously slavers who were basically keeping watch along the Kentucky shores, both for people escaping bondage and for people of African descent. Even though the Ohio, you know, they talk, they described it as the River Jordan because it is this amazing symbol of what separated the free states from the slave states.
That Jordan River is cool and chilly. Lord, I got to cross it.
It was a very, very dangerous space if you were African American, even if you were free.
And they stopped to rest there for a few days. And three riders came up and inquired, you know, what they were doing. Tried to befriend them. Wanted to check papers. Saw they had papers.
And started talking to William Bright Connor about maybe selling his horses. He wasn't interested in selling.
So they left. Later that day, one of the riders returned.
So this white man from this party of three men who had come to talk to William Bright Connor about selling his horse, and he admits that actually these three men, it was their intent that as soon as the party fell asleep, they were going to come and capture them and sell them into slavery. The entire party. They were on the banks of the Ohio River.
To travel that far and to be that close.
They must have been in Kentucky because they were just over from the Indiana border.
He said, but I will return tonight if you have everybody ready. And I'm going to take you to another place where you can cross safely. But when I return, I don't want to talk to anybody. It's just got to be quiet and we're going to have to move.
They were supposed to trust this person?
There was a discussion between William Bright Connor and the other members of the group about, do we listen to this guy, or maybe he's taking you away to an area where it's better for them to waylay you? Or is he honest, and is he telling you the truth? Is he really concerned and really going to take you to a safer place to cross? You don't know.
In the end, they decided to trust him.
As promised, the guy returned.
They wandered through the woods all night. They got thoroughly lost. He was taking them to strange places. And they finally came to the shore just as dawn was breaking.
And you don't want them to hear the wagon moving along the way. Got to be quiet. Then we had a lot of conversation. And he led them, I estimated, about a mile down the river's edge.
And there was a place and a way that they could cross there.
And he bid them farewell.
And as they crossed, they could see, just up the river, a horde of people who had obviously been waiting for them. And they could hear the screams of rage from these people as they were crossing the river.
They were actually very disgusted and alarming voices and very upset.
They lost their prey.
So they made that journey safely.
But their journey wasn't over yet. After the Connors and Tylers crossed the river, they traveled north through Michigan and then settled in Canada.
These are people from North Carolina. It's enormously challenging with a very short growing season in Canada to make it as a farmer.
So William Bright and the group moved from Canada back down into Cassopolis, Michigan.
And that's where they were when the Civil War hit. That was where they joined the U.S. 102nd and saw a lot of action during the Civil War, members of the Connor and the Tyler families.
And then from Cassopolis, Michigan, the whole group moved to Covert.
The final frontier. Van Buren County was actually the last county in the lower portion of Michigan to be cleared of the indigenous people there, whose land it rightly was.
So the Connors and Tylers moved to Covert because the federal government was selling this land at a very affordable rate.
They actually bought property along the lake where there's a lot of pine trees.
And so when the Connors and the Tylers arrived in Covert, Michigan, some of their neighbors, who were called Pokagans, and a lot of single white men who were sort of going off to seek their fortune.
The Pokagan families bought the land in Covert with the money they'd been given for their land the federal government forced them to leave.
The more I study this migration movement, the more I realize that what happened in Covert was very unusual.
So just after the Civil War, in this tiny West Michigan settlement, you've got children of white and African-American pioneers and Pokagans going to school together.
They farmed together, and that's what made it very interesting, that because a lot of this was against the law. So this was an interesting thing.
Particularly given the fact that what was happening, this radical racial harmony that was occurring in Covert, was occurring at the very same time that most of the nation was turning its back on such ideals. This was not a case of whites paternalistically allowing African Americans a few freedoms. This is about a group of highly politicized and very courageous African Americans arriving in a community and saying, "We have fought for this nation. We have seen our brethren die for this nation. We are not going to be treated as second-class citizens."
To learn more about Covert, check out Annalisa Cox's book,
A Stronger Kinship, One Town's Extraordinary Story of Hope and Faith.
Ted Anderson drives west to Covert every summer for his family reunion. The story of their journey from North Carolina across the Ohio River is always shared.
Everybody's got a story. Some are very extraordinary stories. I just happen to know mine. It might be good for somebody to look into theirs, because this is part of the soul of the person.
The Covert story is slated to be featured at the Smithsonian National Museum of African American History and Culture, opening in 2015. You're listening to Migration Stories. This is The Living Room on Michigan Radio. I'm Allison Downey.
Calling all your friends and lovers, the people gather round. Listen up, the good time of ramblers. Listen up, your sorrow bound. I got a tale to tell you, Lord. You know it won't take long. When you wake up in the morning, look for me now, I'll be gone. Will I find myself a pretty little girl in those wine-soaked days? Hands off all the cricket songs and the whippoorwill not far away. Traveled around the country looking for a piece of ground. We built ourselves a fine little cabin, and the winter came around. And like an old bird on a rusty wing, it takes me far too long to fly home in the spring. But when the cold wind gets you, dies that acid noose. It hits the ground, singing, if that love couldn't hold it together, then the water won't wash it down. Like an old bird on a rusty wing, it takes me far too long to fly home in the spring. When the cold wind gets you, ties that acid noose through. People, don't you let it tear your good love loose. Little girls on the 219 headed for Birmingham.
I'm thinking about finding another homestead. She's thinking about a good time, man. That rail car's rough and rocky, and no one knows her name. She's watching that smoke come pouring out and singing that sweet refrain like a bird on a rusty wing. It takes me far too long to fly home in the spring. But when the cold wind gets you, ties that icy noose. Oh. People, don't you let it tear your good love loose. People, don't you let it tear your good love loose.
That was Rusty Wing by Joshua Davis. He's joined today by Laura Bates and Jen Siggett on backup vocals, Mike Shimon on the cajon, and Mike the Reverend Lynch on keyboards. Coming up, more music from Joshua, and then a new immigrant tries to get home from the car dealership.
Face unsmiling, arms sagging, he turns completely in the seat. Us again, in a voice like a whip.
What's that you say?
That story in 10 minutes. This is The Living Room on Michigan Radio. I'm Allison Downey.
The goose ships are rolling in. The night sky's twisting round. Honey, baby, where you been? To tell me what you found. I found that the weeks slip through you, yeah, quicker than a falling rain, faster than a southbound train. It's winter, then it's autumn again.
This is The Living Room. I'm Allison Downey. Lansing-based songwriter Joshua Davis recently stopped by the studio for a chat and a performance with his band. Here he is with Last Winter in the Copper Country. And like Rusty Wing, Joshua wrote this one about his parents.
They met in Detroit in the late 60s, and they were part of the, after being involved in the civil rights movement and protest movement, they were kind of back to the landers involved in that movement. And so they took off for the North Country. They kind of roamed around the states and Michigan, and finally ended up in Marquette County, where my dad was a carpenter and he built a house and a homestead up there. You know, they lived way back in the woods, no electricity, no running water. That's where I was born, was up there. And my dad would go away to work. He picked up jobs really quickly as a carpenter. And my mom would be alone with me all day, you know, without. The closest friend is maybe 5 miles away. Town is maybe an hour away. And a lot of times you'd just be totally snowed in there. And so they separated and she moved back down to Detroit. And so the song is kind of about how difficult that was for her and for both of them and what I kind of remember from that. Summer, you went a-walking.
walking and singing too. The song was for your unborn child, and they named the road for you. Spring is life returning, summer white and wild and free, but fall is a tale of what's to come, and it's for frozen tragedy. And the days are getting shorter, and you can't sleep at night, and your path is getting clearer. You can plainly see it's your last winter in the copper country. It's your last winter in the copper country. A tiny little airport, biggest thing in that tiny little town. You would said a prayer and washed your hands by the time that tiny little plane had set down. I don't remember that airport, nor the summer, spring, or fall, but that howling wind bubbles in my blood, and it makes, oh, it makes my skin crawl. Valley, there's something stirring. Was that a voice calling out your name? And your baby boy is crying. Why don't you bounce him on your knee? It's your last winter in the copper country. It's your last winter in the copper country. Oh.
That was the song Last Winter in the Copper Country by Joshua Davis. He's going to play one more for us. And this is a new song that came out of a recent trip he took to Israel and the West Bank.
I was asked by this nonprofit called On the Ground to be involved in this event that they call the Run Across Palestine. So we went to Israel and the West Bank, and the runners, there was, I think, six American runners and runners from other parts of the world as well, ran 129 miles. It was a marathon a day for 5 days from South Hebron Hills to Jenin in the north. My role was kind of to be there as a cultural emissary, you know, somebody who is an artist from the States, from Michigan, bringing that experience to them and soaking up their arts and their culture there. And so at night, in the evenings after the runners would run, we would set up these kind of concerts and festivals and cultural exchanges with dancers and musicians and artists. And it was a really intense experience. It was really life-changing experience. One of the things that we did was every village that we stopped, we brought them 500 olive saplings. That's their main industry. That's their main crop. And so we went down and we found a line of Israeli soldiers there. We're trying to plant these trees, and there was some pushing back and forth. There was tear gas, and you know, the Palestinian kids were throwing stones at the military, and so there was this huge altercation. And so I'm trying to find a way to not necessarily take a side, but to just say, look at all this. Like, is this what we want? Is this how things need to be in this sacred place?
Wedding songs drifted through the streets of the house of princes. The wind rose up and blew the clouds back home to rest. We gathered in the garden in the midday heat in the house of princes. A silhouette of Jerusalem's sage danced like a drunken guest in the house of princes. With two candles and a twine in the house of princes. Down at the picket line in the house of princes, standing in the orchard side by side,
what a welcome. What a welcome for the brave. Walk down to the fields in the house, in the house, in the house of princes. On my left, the ancient crooked trees. Olive oil anointed the shields in the house of princes. On my right, perfect lines of soldiers stood at ease. House of princes. With two candles intertwined in the house of princes. Down at the picket line in the house of princes. Standing in the orchard side by side. Oh, what a welcome. What a welcome for the bride. House of princes, two candles intertwined in the house of princes. Down at the picket line in the house of princes, standing in the orchard side by side. Oh, what a welcome! What a welcome for the bride. Sabbath bride in the house of princes. With slings and stones and tear gas up above. Before the gas could cloud my eyes in the house of princes. I caught a glimpse of her weeping for lost love. Well, her tears fell on this broken world. They fell upon the flags on the floor. Fell upon my left and right. Fill the darkness and the light. Fill all sense of pleasure and pain. Fell upon each other's fear. I saw three lonely stars appear. It was a cold, clear night. In the house, in the house of princes. Talking with my baby on the phone, so far away. The stars were shining their sweet light. In the house of princes. I watched the blockades flicker through a thousand shades of gray.
It's really beautiful. Very powerful.
Thanks.
That was the song House of Princes, recorded live from Studio East at Michigan Radio. You heard Joshua Davis singing and playing guitar, Laura Bates and Jen Siggett on backup vocals, Mike Shimon on cajon, and Mike the Reverend Lynch on keyboards. Joshua, thank you so much for coming today. It's great to see you again.
It's great to see you too, Allison. Thanks for having me.
You can learn more about Joshua Davis and his music over at michiganradio.org. You're listening to The Living Room. I'm Allison Downey on Michigan Radio.
I'm Zilka Joseph. I'm a teacher and a writer. I grew up in Kolkata, moved to Chicago in 97, and then moved to Michigan in 2000. And in Chicago, we didn't have a car. We just used the L. So the first time we came to Michigan, we had to buy a car. And it was exciting, of course, to have one. But then you had to take it to the dealership for servicing or work or, you know, get something fixed. Then the shuttle driver would pick you up and take you back home and then bring you back when your car was fixed. And this is when I would be very nervous because I was not used to it and was talking to all these strangers. And it just felt very strange because this conversation just started up and then he wouldn't stop. the car dealership shuttle driver.
Hell, I have no idea where she wants to go,
say the hard gray eyes of the shuttle driver as he glares at me. As I tell him where, he says,
Huh? What? What's that you say?
Face unsmiling, old arm sagging, he turns completely in the seat. Us again.
What's that you say?
I repeat, I live near Trader Joe's. His craggy face burns red, says,
I don't get it.
The new Trader Joe's store on Walton, I say slowly. The one opposite Oakland University. He's maybe 70. I know he doesn't think he's hard of hearing. He tells me he
can't understand immigrants.
I say our accents are different, can be confusing. Tell him I'm an English teacher, have been for 16 years.
No kidding.
He says, looks at me hard, lips curled as if he ate something bad, swerves to miss a car.
Don't they know they should speak English if they want to live here? My father came all the way from Russia. He knew English and even Polish. He did. But me, I don't know no Russian. I'm not one for languages and that kind of stuff. And you?
Four, I say, was brought up bilingual.
Huh, no kidding.
His driving's jerky, foot heavy on the brake, stares at me hard, forgets where to turn to pick up the woman waiting near Nino Salvaggio's, tells me twice.
She needs to be dropped off first.
Though he picked me up first. Ah, how he has to keep everyone happy.
Now why do they all come here? Yeah, high salaries, I know.
But what if you want a new life, I say? For you, for your kids.
Yeah.
Chews his cheek. Ask.
Do you have family in your country?
Yes, parents in their 80s, friends, students, yes. He runs a red light, looks puzzled, asks.
Do you see them often?
Once in 2 years, maybe. Too expensive. I miss them. He's missed Nino's long ago. He breaks hard, frowns, clucks. Hell, did you see it? He asks.
Hell, you should have told me.
Swings the old van around. Midturn says.
For years where I worked at Ford Financial, they fired contractors. Couldn't understand them. Wouldn't speak English. And the other day, had this old man to drop off. An Oriental he was. From Chrysler. Hell, I had no idea where he wanted to go. They should all learn English.
They do, I say. They do. Some are better at it than others. They struggle hard all day, like my students at Oakland Community College, working shifts, working 3 jobs, working at grammar, late into the night, so they can go to college, rush to class, eyes red, become doctors, lawyers, engineers.
Does your husband speak English?
I say, fluently.
No kidding.
Where my husband works, I say, there are folks from all over the world speaking English with different accents, and many don't understand each other.
No kidding,
he says, and bellows loudly, whacks my hand, pushes back his Red Wings cap with both hands. The van wanders. Cars honk all around. It is 50 minutes since I stepped into this van. It is only 15 from the dealership on Rochester Road to my apartment.
Here we are,
he says, squints as I open the door, says,
you're an interesting woman, very candid.
I try to smile. My stomach is churning. We learn from each other, I say. Thanks, goodbye.
What's that you say?
Gray eyes hard, face unsmiling, arms sagging. He turns completely in the seat. Us again, in a voice like a whip.
What's that you say?
That was Michael Crittenden and Zilka Joseph reading from her poem, The Car Dealership Shuttle Driver. Zilka Joseph was born in Bombay, raised in Calcutta, India, and now she lives in Ann Arbor. She's the author of the books Lands I Live In and What Dread. So that's it for today's show. For more on how to share your story or music with us, go to michiganradio.org. The Living Room was produced by Zach Rosen and me, Allison Downey. My song Begin Again was recorded at Big Sky Recording Studios in Ann Arbor and featured Rod Capps on lead guitar, Stephen Mullen on organ, Sue Gillis and Annie Capps on harmony vocals, John Austin on bass, Chuck Mock on drums, and me on guitar and vocals. Special thanks to Tamar Charney, Steve Schramm, Bob Scon, Terry Blackhawk, Annie and Rod Capps, Michael Crittenden, Kathy Hartenstein, Shauna Gold, Kyle Norris, Chris Brucey and the South Street Staffers, Elizabeth Terrell, Arthur Downey, Joyce Lucier and my family, Shira Heisler, and John and Michael Austin. This is The Living Room. Thanks for listening. I'm Allison Downey.
I don't know nothing.